From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, lots of news from TV land, including the Emmy Awards going without a host. Then filmmaker Nanfu Wong made the documentary One Child Nation. It's about the atrocities and propaganda behind the child restriction laws in China.
Governments control women's reproductive choice is not unique in China. It's happening in the U.S. It's happening in many other countries as well.
And 20 years after the release of Stanley Kubrick's last movie, we revisit the music of Eyes Wide Shut with the film's composer. All that coming up on The Frame. The television business is changing rapidly, but there's one constant, and that is twice a year, the nation's TV reviewers and reporters gather to hear presentations from the broadcast networks and major cable channels. The group is called the Television Critics Association, and the TCA's summer meetings conclude tomorrow. Daniel Feinberg is a TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter and a longtime TCA member. We talked about today's announcement that this year's Emmy Awards, just like the Oscars, won't have a host.
That is the news this morning out of Fox's TCA press tour panel, where Charlie Collier officially said what I guess we've all been suspecting for a couple weeks, that Fox would not be bothering with a host for the Emmys. He gave the sort of general explanation that they looked over the TV landscape, saw all of the TV shows that were ending, and decided that it would be better to celebrate the programming of the year than to take time up with a revolving host.
Since we last spoke, ABC has presented, FX has presented, Fox is in the middle of its presentation, and NBC Universal will present tomorrow. Overall, have you detected any kind of patterns to what the traditional broadcast networks are doing?
I think that it's been a couple of years now where basically the broadcast networks have all emphasized the exact same point, which is we're still the biggest audience, we're still doing innovative things, we're still alive and vibrant, and also get ready to check out our streaming platforms, which will surely be the way that you watch all TV in the future. So they, like everybody else, understand that things are going in streaming directions, and it behooves you to have a platform that you're going to be supporting and buttressing in the future.
FX announced that it is going to make a fourth season of Atlanta. I don't remember seeing a third season of Atlanta. That hasn't happened yet, has it?
No, you did not miss anything. The third and fourth seasons of Atlanta were formally announced at FX's TCA Day. The third season will begin production in the spring. Both seasons will be 8 episodes. But basically, FX has a whatever you want to do, whenever you want to do it, just let us know Donald Glover rule. And I believe basically what Donald Glover told them was, I would like the opportunity to do 2 seasons, and then we'll figure things out. And FX said, okay, sure, come on.
FX also said the next American Crime story is going to be about Monica Lewinsky. They were contemplating doing something about Hurricane Katrina. Obviously, a lot of conversations around the timing of its making and its release. What did FX head John Landgraf have to say, not only about this decision, but about when it's going to come out around the 2020 election?
Well, the plan is to have the impeachment season of American Crime Story come out next September, end of September. So that's September 2020, at which point, you know, people might be vaguely aware that there's a presidential election coming up. I kind of got the feeling that John Landgraf was at least partially unprepared for some of the concerns that popped up immediately on Twitter and across the internet, that this was exactly the sort of thing that our current president and the Fox News crew would use as basically the new front in their never-ending war against the Clintons. If we're being honest, I can't imagine that that's what Ryan Murphy would be thinking that he was doing here. I think there's no question that the focus of the season is going to be on the quote-unquote women of the scandal. And so Monica Lewinsky being a producer on the series, which was always a big deal to Ryan Murphy, is going to be a central thing. It is presumably going to be her story. But yeah, there was some concern on Twitter that this might in some way benefit the current administration becoming a talking point. John Landgraf said he did not expect it would.
And Fox has the sixth and I think final episode of Empire. I think they announced that Jussie Smollett will not return to the series. Is there talk of a spinoff or the next iteration in that show's future?
What they talked about was that they're in the Lee Daniels business. They're in the Danny Strong business. So if Lee Daniels and Danny Strong have a project that they want to pitch to them, they would be happy to hear it. I think that was all that they wanted to say. They didn't say, oh, we're actively developing a spinoff or something. There was sort of the inference that basically what they want to do with this last season is give Empire a send-off, and they obviously don't want the Jussie Smollett thing to overshadow whatever the last season plans are. But yeah, so Empire is going. Lee Daniels and Danny Strong are both part of the family, and all hail Empire. Jussie Smollett need not apply.
NBC has yet to present, but you've probably seen previews and clips and maybe episodes of a bunch of new shows. I asked you this the last time we talked. Has anything popped in your mind, something you're either especially eager to look at or have seen the pilot for and can recommend already?
The simple answer to that question is really very similar to last time. Not really. I have yet to see a breakout hit among the new network shows. Anything could happen. Without any question, the most exciting thing that NBC is paneling on the last day of press tour is, naturally enough, the final season of The Good Place. So I think that that is easily the most anticipated panel of the last day of press tour. And if there were a new The Good Place or the next The Good Place in the fall lineups for any of the networks, I definitely have not seen any hint or indication. There are definitely some interesting things happening on cable and streaming. Broadcast is mostly going for middle of the road, sometimes inoffensive things.
Daniel Feinberg is a TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter. He is also the president of the Television Critics Association.
Former.
RIP. RIP Daniel Feinberg's presidency.
As of Saturday, no longer the president of the Television Critics Association.
Well, we'll look into the impeachment of Daniel Feinberg. Daniel, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, a new documentary on China's one-child policy and the horrific lengths the country went to enforcing it. Nanfu Wang's new documentary is called One Child Nation. It's a personal look at China's 35-year rule on the reproductive rights of millions of families, including Wang's. It was a time in China's history that the filmmaker had experienced but repressed over the years until Wang found out she was going to be a mom herself.
And that pregnancy, the process, and even the first few weeks, I started noticing my perspective shifting. I suddenly became very aware of the dangers around me, and I'm more conscious about the issues around, you know, whether it's current or in the future, because now I wanted to protect my child. I started thinking about the one-child policy and the children, and especially the women, the mothers, when they couldn't protect their child and had no control over what would happen next. How did they even live the life from day to day under that fear? So that's when I started asking my mom, how was it like for you when you were pregnant with me? And the stories that she told me made me realize how little that I knew or even thought about the one-child policy.
So if you just hear the name and the phrase, one child, you imagine that basically everybody's told, just have one kid. That's how we're going to prosper. And that isn't really the way it played out. That if you had more than one kid or tried to have more than one kid, you faced sterilization or a forced abortion, or if you had a girl and not a boy, you would give that girl up or essentially just leave that baby on the side of the road. And in your travels, you visit with a midwife in your hometown, and she, by her own math, has performed thousands of forced sterilizations and thousands of abortions, very many of them late term, where the fetus is viable and she essentially just kills the baby when it's aborted. So I'm going to ask you a little bit more about her and what her story meant to the film and what it meant to you.
It was a very surprising interview. I went to meet her because she was the midwife in my village and who helped deliver me and almost every child that was born in the village for the past 30 years. So I started by asking her a very simple question, which I thought was a warm-up question. How many babies did you deliver throughout your career? And little did I expect that she would say, oh, I don't remember the number I delivered, but I did 50,000 to 60,000 abortions. And that completely shocked me by the amount of forced abortions and sterilizations. But also, she's just a village midwife, and there are thousands of people like her throughout the country. And what it was going to be like for the entire country if she did that. And what was more shocking was what she told me later, how she felt guilty and traumatized by all the experiences.
And now she works to help people who have infertility problems have kids, and she keeps these beautiful mementos of those families that have had children around a place where I suspect not that long ago she was doing the exact opposite.
Exactly. And I think the meeting with her sort of like shifted the direction of the film too, because before then, I thought the film was a simple story of perpetrators and victims. And then after meeting her, I realized that there's no such thing as perpetrators, because these people who carried out the policy are also victims to some extent.
We're talking with Nanfu Wang, whose film is called One Child Nation. Artists in China, some artists have made sure, and I think you would be in this group, made sure that the story is not forgotten. You talk about a photographer named Pen Wang, and he says, and I'm quoting him now, the most tragic thing for a nation is to have no memory. So what role are artists like yourself and Pen Wang have in documenting what actually happened?
I believe a country's future largely depends on the country's past and how the nation remembers the past. And personally, I've witnessed how my generation or younger generation growing up never heard of the Tiananmen Square protest, understood very little about the Cultural Revolution, and have not even heard of Great Leap Forward, things like that. All of those events have been erased from China's history. What remains is the national narrative from the authority. And I am seeing that happening with the one-child policy too. When it ended, all the reports from China was how positive this policy was. And the people who have lived through the policy, they would either pass away in several years and all of the memory would be gone. And I am very afraid that would happen, like all the past recent history happened in China. So I felt the urgency and the strong responsibility of recording this part of history.
I want to play part of the narration from the film. This is your coming to a realization after talking with a lot of people about the policy.
One thing that struck me was that everyone we spoke to said the same things about the policy. As I heard the answer again and again, I had no choice. I realized that you could ask anyone in any part of China about how the one-child policy affected them, and all of them would say the same thing.
I think it's worth noting, too, that as a child, you were among the propagandists. I mean, you were in a choir singing about the importance of one child and celebrating it. Was there a moment where, in the making of this film, you had a fundamental epiphany where you realized something that you'd never really considered before, or was it kind of a slow trickle of information that started changing your perspective?
Yes, there was. I remember one night I started thinking about my childhood memory of the one-child policy or my encounters about any one-child-related events. And then I started realizing when I was a child, when I was going to middle school, I would feel embarrassed and ashamed when people found out that I had a younger brother, because then what came after was people's judgment. You must come from a backwards family. Your parents must be uneducated. You are selfish to have a child. You are criminals. So I started thinking, where did the embarrassment and shame came from? And it was almost like in a therapist's office, but I'm doing my own therapy.
The United States and China are involved in the middle of a trade war right now. But there's another part of this story that involves the United States and China, and that is forced adoptions and how children are bartered and sold. And I think their family history is misrepresented. So how much complicity does the United States have in all of this and these adoption agencies that are for profit on both sides of the country's borders?
So what we found out was when the international adoption program was introduced in the 1990s, the Chinese authority realized that there is profit to be made through this program. Every orphan that being adopted, they could get tens of thousands of dollars from adopted family. So what happened after that was the local government would allow a woman to carry the baby to full term and give birth, and then take the baby away in the name of violating the one-child policy and put the baby in the orphanage for adoption. And I really believe that all the adoptive families, that they, to some extent, are also victims of the policy, because there are a lot of unintended consequences that the families didn't know where their children come from. They believed that they were orphans, but in fact, their parents are looking, searching for their child.
This is the second film that you've made about China that is not a flattering portrait of the country. The other was Hooligan Sparrow, about activists and justice for girls who have been sexually abused. How would you describe your relationship with China? And I have to say, I was a little surprised you were able to go in there with cameras and work again.
I know. There were a lot of uncertainties whether I could go back. And I didn't try until 2 years after I made Hooligan Sparrow. And a lot of calculated, you know, strategy, planning. And eventually I went. And what was ironic was also between Hooligan Sparrow and One Child Nation, I made another film that was about America's mental illness and homeless problems. And that film got invited to be shown in China officially. So it passed the censorship. And that was when I realized, okay, maybe it was good that I could go back, because there was an official invitation.
This is a uniquely Chinese story, but it does feel like it has global resonance. And I'm wondering, for modern American viewers who may not know anything about this, what do you hope they take away, not so much about what happened in China, but about propaganda and government and speaking truth to power?
One is propaganda, that it is not unique that propaganda exists in China. It might be more extreme. And in a society that is supposed to be more free than China, the propaganda is even subtler, which can be hidden in the social media feeds, in the TV reports, in the political campaigns that people have a hard time recognizing. So I hope that this film could remind them to reflect on their own society and recognize the propaganda. And then the other thing is, the film really shows what would happen when the government takes away the choice from women and from every individual. And government's control, women's reproductive choice is not unique in China. It's happening in the U.S. It's happening in many other countries as well. And we hope that the film would show you the true human consequences.
Nanfu Wang is the co-director, producer, and subject of the documentary One Child Nation. The film is out in theaters Friday, August 9th. Nanfu, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, Stanley Kubrick preferred to use classical music to score his films, but that changed with Eyes Wide Shut. Twenty years ago this summer, Stanley Kubrick's final film, Eyes Wide Shut, was released 4 months after the director died. One of its most memorable sequences is a cult-like orgy that features some striking music. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving visited its composer, Jocelyn Pook, in London.
No one used music quite like Stanley Kubrick. He was obsessive about it, and he liked control. After Spartacus in 1960, he rarely even worked with a composer, preferring to use existing classical music instead. Jocelyn Pook certainly never expected to get a phone call from Stanley Kubrick. She never even planned on composing music for film.
You know, I enjoyed writing music, but I think I grew up with this idea that, you know, you had to be a very particular kind of virtuoso, pianist, kind of conductor, sort of very confident. I just thought people like me didn't become composers.
Pook grew up in London, and she studied music in college. She played viola with a parade of pop artists throughout the 1980s, including PJ Harvey and Susie and the Banshees.
Southern trees, bear strange fruit.
In the mid-90s, she started writing music for experimental theater and dance companies, influenced by minimalist composers like Steve Reich and Philip Glass, and using lots of vocal samples.
My Bible is this compilation of CDs called Voix du Monde, Voices of the World. It's like field recordings from 70s and 80s, even earlier, I think, from all over the world, from like Pygmy African tribes to, you know, yodelers in Switzerland, you know.
This fairly obscure piece, Blow the Wind, P.A. Jesu, got Pook a big mobile phone ad, which landed her a deal with Virgin Records. In 1997, she released her first album, Deluge. An English choreographer, Yolanda Snaith, was playing that album in rehearsal. Cue Stanley Kubrick.
And that's how he heard my music. He walked in at the right time.
Kubrick hired Snaith to choreograph the notorious masked ball scene in Eyes Wide Shut. Half an hour after Kubrick heard Pook's music in that rehearsal, he gave her a ring.
I got called. I was on the other line and I had to put Stanley on hold. So go back to the other person and say, oh, I've got to go because it's Stanley Kubrick. And he patiently waited. And he said, well, I'm really interested in this piece you've written and I'd love to hear more of your music.
Eyes Wide Shut is an erotic nightmare starring Tom Cruise as Dr. William Harford, who finds out that his wife, played by his then real-life wife, Nicole Kidman, fantasized about having an affair. And he wanders out into a sexual dark night of the soul. He learns about a secret orgy in a mansion in the countryside and discovers a bizarre ritual with masked men and women.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Password, sir?
Fidelio.
Thank you, sir.
Kubrick wanted to use Pook's music for the arrival at the masked ball and the following orgy. Pook had originally written the track Backwards Priest for a theater piece about homophobia in the church. She took the recording of a priest in a Romanian Orthodox church and ran it backwards.
It was like really primitive the way I was working on like reel to reel at that time, you know, like 8-track. I was also experimenting with, you know, reversing voice, and I literally did that by turning the tape round.
The marriage between that track and that scene was instantly iconic. However,
the orgy scene wasn't so easy. I remember at one point he said, look, sexy music, you know, and it's like, what is sexy music? You know, it's like, and I did so many sketches for that bloody orgy scene, but he ended up finding an existing piece of mine for that, which I never would have suggested in a million years.
How do you explain how you like music and why? You know, it's the one thing you really can't say.
Christiana Kubrick, the director's widow, remembers Jocelyn Pook coming over to their grand mansion in the countryside, which is where she and I chatted. In fact, I passed several of the masks from Eyes Wide Shut as I entered.
I know he liked her music. He gushed over certain bits of it and listened to it again and again and again. And he was a person who played music a lot anyway, and he particularly liked hers. Yeah, we were fans.
people always say, "Oh, what was it like working with Stanley Kubrick?" But it was just like any other director. He wasn't a control freak at all. And from my perspective, he was completely open to new ideas and, you know, exploring. And yeah, it was normal and nice.
Two words you wouldn't expect to hear about the creation of the masked ball scene in Eyes Wide Shut. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn in the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll be back here tomorrow.